Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. If you missed our biggest book show of the year at 9, you can find the whole list on the thread and hear it on my podcast. Later this hour, some international news from the BBC, but now we're in depth on the money we give and don't to our faith communities. If you slipped an envelope into the offertory plate in your church this holiday season, or you made a donation to your mosque or temple to signify your commitment to their work, you're part of a tradition of giving that remains strong, but not as vibrant as it once was. An article in the New York Times caught our eye last month, and we wanted to explore it more deeply. The Times reports that although religious institutions still receive the lion's share of charitable giving in America, the overall share of that giving has declined. Here's some context. In 1990, the share of charitable giving to religious institutions was about 50%. Now, that's all giving, and then the share to religious institutions. Last year, that share was around 32%. So our conversation this hour, if Americans are still giving to charity, and we are, does it matter that we're not giving as much to our churches, our mosques, our synagogues? And as our guests join us, I'd like to hear how you think about this in your own family. Does a significant part of your family's charitable giving go to a faith community? And if you've altered the way you give, tell me why. So I want to know, as we talk about this idea of giving to religious institutions, if something has changed in your own family. Do you still give the way you always have to religious institutions? If you've altered the way you give, maybe you give to different places that support the mission that your faith community supports. Tell me why. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Eileen Heisman, is CEO of the National Philanthropic Trust, and she's with us today from near Philly. And Eileen, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Stacey Palmer is with us, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy magazine. Uh-oh, don't tell me I'm going to have a hard time saying that. And she's with us today from Washington. And Stacey, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Terrific to join you.
So, Eileen, that Times article that we spotted quoted Giving USA on the decline. And I thought we could put even some more context around this. 25 or 26 years ago, many, many Americans were giving to their churches. Is that because many, many more of us were going to church, or is there another reason for this, do you think?
I think many more people were going to church and found that affiliating with a religious institution was part of the norm of who they were as citizens in whatever community they lived in. And I think the extent to which people identify with religion first and their self-identity has really changed in the last 20 years. It didn't surprise me at all to see that shift. And I think I'm not sure it's going to be ending anytime soon. There's been some research that millennials, a huge percentage of them identify with a nun identity.
So N-O-N-E, right.
Yes, N-O-N-E, right. So if you look at that trend, I think we're going to be seeing more of this shift. I don't think this one-third now is going to be the end of it, piece of the pie getting smaller.
Stacey, this idea of religious identification and generational change, do you agree this is a big influence on this?
Absolutely. With people not feeling as close to their churches, synagogues, and mosques, they're just not as likely to give to them. That doesn't mean that they're not giving. It just means that they're not giving to those causes. So, you know, this is definitely a long-term trend because we really don't see this resurgence of religion coming back in any kind of way that's going to influence giving. So I think we are seeing a real division of the pie.
Yeah. You know, Stacey, I think you've noted something again that's pretty important here, which is it isn't that Americans are not giving to missions and organizations and causes that they believe in. We are still giving a substantial amount of money to charity every year. It's just shifting. how we're giving, yes?
Exactly. It is indeed. I will say that one of the things that people who are fundraisers have always been concerned about, though, is that the percentage of income that Americans give, it hasn't increased in any kind of dramatic way over the years. So it is a fixed pie. And so while religion is getting less and other causes are getting more, the real challenge is how do we increase giving overall and make sure that all of the causes that are doing terrific work are getting the money they deserve.
You know, Eileen, that's something I hadn't really thought about, that the amount we're giving has been somewhat stagnant.
I think it's important to clarify.
Okay.
We've been giving about 2% of the gross domestic product for the last 45 years, but because the gross domestic product is a growing pie, the actual dollar amount has gone up. So while the 2% seems like a static number, as our economy grows, that number actually grows. So I think sometimes people look at the 2% and think it means that the dollar amount is stagnant, but the dollar amount isn't. So it's just important to know that. I think there's another piece of this religion that sometimes gets mentioned and sometimes doesn't, which is I don't think people equate spirituality with religion. So I don't think it means that people aren't spiritual or don't believe or embrace spiritual qualities in their life. I think it's not manifesting itself in formal religion and, you know, in the way that it was 20 years ago, where you have to belong to a place of worship. So spirituality is still a part of American lives. It's just not manifesting itself in the exact same way.
This is a good point. And I was thinking about, I was raised in the Lutheran church. I remember Sundays, my parents putting the envelope, you know, into the plate and then committing during capital campaigns. And I thought, now that's not something that I do, but I still give to causes that I know the Lutheran church and organization would support. I'm kind of an example of what you guys are talking about, that I still believe in those causes and contributing to them, but I think there's other ways to support them than just via the church. I mean, that's kind of what we're seeing here, isn't it, Eileen?
It is. There's a lot of people like you who took a look at the principles of how they were raised, and they look at it as more general than just giving inside the religion. I mean, the other thing that's really interesting is that assimilation among religious people, so we're not as segregated as we were about, you know, if you were Catholic, your friends were Catholic. If you're Jewish, all your friends were Jewish. I think there's much more assimilation of religions across young people. They don't have people in the same kind of silos and pockets. And so because of that, you know, they look at what they want to give to is not just the religion, but the community at large. And they don't see the divisions as much. I think baby boomers and the greatest generation who lived through World War II saw silos of communities. And I think the younger people, I think a lot of that is absent. And so they're much more wide thinking about when they think of giving back.
Do you think, Stacey, some of this, the non-denominational faith communities have also had some kind of impact on this?
I think so, because, you know, but it's really the overall environment of fundraising. Think of all the solicitations you're getting this time of year, and I can barely keep count of them in my mailbox.
No, so
you know,
true.
So there are so many causes that are out there and so many wonderful causes, and we didn't have that ability to find out about them electronically through social media in so many kinds of ways that now we've got so much information and so many choices. That's one of the reasons that giving to so many different causes is happening. So, you know, while the religious affiliation issue is important, I think we have to set it in the larger context of the fact that there are so many causes that are out there and so many in need.
This is a conversation, if you've just joined us, about the idea of religious giving. And although, as we've noted, and we've noted the numbers on this, Americans still give a lot to organizations through charitable donations, we are not giving the way we once did to religious institutions. We haven't talked about yet the consequences for those religious institutions, and I want to, but we're also kind of getting a handle on what is motivating the difference in the way people think about where they're going to contribute, our attachment to faith communities, the idea that, as one of our guests just said, there's not such bright lines between different denominations, the way we think differently about how we're going to support causes. And I would like to hear from you on this. If a significant part of your family's charitable giving goes to a faith community, tell me how you think about that. If you've altered the way you give to your faith community, I'd like to hear about that as well. I'd like to know why. how the conversation sounds in your own household. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about it on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where a listener says less money going to ornate buildings that are empty 80% of the time and pay no taxes is not a bad thing. That's progress, in their opinion. To the phones, to Pat in Otsego. Hi, Pat. How does this work for you?
Well, I think we're finding in our faith community that people are just wanting more transparency about where the money is going, and you don't always get that in faith communities. And so people want to know that their money is actually doing good work. And I'm finding that people within our church are wanting to give money directly to organizations, and they don't know necessarily that the church giving is going to mission. Is it going to new construction for the building? And so people are actually saying, you know, I want to know where the money's going, what it's doing, and opting not to give it to a place where there isn't necessarily transparency. And I think you're really seeing that sometimes within the Catholic Church, but in other church communities as well.
Right. Yeah. Stacey, do you think that's a big part of this idea that Pat brings up of transparency?
Yes, that's a really important issue. And that's something that isn't just affecting people's thinking about giving to faith communities. There's demand on all nonprofits to be more transparent, and very few of them have really stood up to that challenge. And I think, you know, in an age of WikiLeaks and all of these things where you can just get information at your fingertips, nonprofits are being expected to provide more information. And yet there's a tension among nonprofits that often want to keep their donors anonymous and protect their confidentiality. And that's a good instinct, too, and certainly the belief that, you know, you don't want to be showy and ostentatious about your giving is a religious belief in some faiths. So that tension comes out quite a bit.
Eileen, is there also tension in some of these organizations having to show accountability in some ways for where the money's going and what it's actually doing?
Well, you know, every charity that has its 501c3, which is the government designation for a charitable entity, has to file a 990 every year. And the 990 actually is a really long document that provides a lot of transparency, but it's difficult to read. And so it probably looks opaque if you're not a seasoned reader of 990s. If you do know how to read a 990, you can actually find out an enormous amount about how a charity operates. One of the issues is it's hard to compare 990s from one to the other because they're all in PDF form. So there's a project now to make them readable, which I think make it much easier in the next 5 or 6 years to figure out, you know, if two charities are doing the exact same thing, is one of them doing differently. I think, though, there's a piece of this that gets kind of wrapped up. You know, for charities to be accountable, they need to collect data, and to collect data, that takes overhead and kind of statistical analysis, and a lot of people are very hostile about giving to overhead. It became demonized several years ago by a couple of advocacy groups in the sector, but it's the overhead that allows you to do strategic planning and to do data analytics. So the very thing that makes people comfortable are analytics, but then people don't want to give to overhead. So it's a very, you know, you get attention on that. But if you can figure out how to read a 990, you will learn a lot. That being said, a lot of religious organizations don't have to file 990s because the religious, they get a special kind of, you know, kind of a trade. They don't have to file them because they existed before the tax laws were in place. So there is an opaqueness to some churches, synagogues, and mosques because they don't file 990s. And for that reason, there is really no way to know how they're spending their money. And so, you know, it may be an imperative, you know, that churches and synagogues and anybody who allows a donor to get a deduction actually has to do a 990, so there is more transparency.
You know, I'm thinking about what you said about overhead isn't sexy and, you know, going out to tell people, hey, we'd like to use your money so that we can do data analytics. I realize that message is not especially compelling, and yet when we talk about accountability, that's where it's all at, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And actually, my graduate degree is in social program evaluation, which is all about data analytics.
Wow.
And the act of getting it, you need scientific approaches. You need to collect data. You need to crunch it. You need to be able to understand what's meaningful and what's not meaningful. There's a great quote by Albert Einstein, which is, not everything that's measurable is important. Not everything that's important is measurable. So you have to be able to distinguish between those things. So here are these donors who may be giving $100, $1,000. None should go to overhead, but they want this dashboard information. So, you know, I think we need to come to terms, if you're going to be a donor and you want impact information, that some portion of your gift has to go to overhead, because that's exactly how charities are able to do that.
Stacey, what would you say about this accountability and the overhead thing?
It's a really big issue for lots of nonprofits, and I think they're greatly frustrated by watchdogs that monitor their expenses and make it seem like you're bad if you're spending money on overhead, because, as Eileen says, that's often the kinds of things that make sure you are a great organization and that you're managing well. And that's exactly what we want people to be spending on. That doesn't mean lavish salaries or chauffeured cars or, you know, any of those kinds of things. It really means having great technology, great data systems, great people who can lead the organization. And that's what some nonprofits that are trying to lead the transparency brigade and be different are breaking down exactly what they're spending money on. So you can look and see, what is it that they're putting their money into, and is it something that you think leads to better management of the organization and greater efficiencies? So I think asking for that kind of information would help donors make more decisions and help nonprofits provide the kind of information that people want. But what most people want to know is, you know, is the nonprofit making a difference? Are
right.
we getting results?
Right.
And those are the kinds of questions that you should always ask. And if a nonprofit can't provide them or say how it's thinking about that, then it's not worth giving to them, because that's a real red flag.
Stacey, can I ask you what you think of a site that I go to a lot, which is Charity Navigator?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's worthwhile, or is there not enough detailed information there for you?
Yeah, a lot of people use Charity Navigator. It's one of the most popular of the websites. And, you know, I think that's one of those cases where you have to think hard about this overhead issue and how much you think is appropriate, and look at their ratings and decide whether the system that they use, does that meet with your values? Are those the kinds of things you care about, or are there other things you care about? Eileen mentioned the 990, the informational tax return that mm-hmm. charities file, and there's a site called GuideStar where you can look that up yourself, and you don't have the filter of the watchdog doing it, so it's not as easy to use.
Okay.
But you can make your own call about whether you think the spending is appropriate or not, and everybody's got a different view of, you know, what do you think is an appropriate salary, how much should go to programs, those kinds of things. And, you know, it's acceptable to make decisions about that based on your own value system rather than looking at how many stars a charity gets.
All right. You're listening, if you've just tuned into this conversation, where we're exploring why the share of the charitable giving that we Americans are committed to has been declining among religious institutions. We're not giving as much to our faith communities, our religious institutions, and hearing some really good analysis from our guests this morning, Eileen Heisman, CEO of the National Philanthropic Trust, and Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy magazine, about why that is. And then hearing from you this morning how you think about giving to your faith community, whether that has changed. I mean, whether there has been, as I said, in my family, there was a long tradition, still is, by the way. My parents still give the way they always have to the church, but I think of it differently, and perhaps you do too, and the generations that follow. And especially if you're a young member of a faith community of some sort, do you think about giving to that faith community differently? Let's say you're 35 and under, belong to a faith community. How do you think about supporting financially that community? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Evan says on Twitter, the 2012 marriage amendment changed things for me. The Catholic Church threw a lot of money at it, and I'm not okay with supporting that. Eileen, I did want to talk about the politics of some of these religious institutions. What do you think?
You know, I think that the millennials who are our social issues are really important, and they don't necessarily embrace the traditions of their forefathers and mothers in those religions. I think when they see things like the marriage amendment not get supported, it really is off-putting. So I'm not surprised to hear Evan say that. And, you know, it's I think that the religious institutions are not shifting as fast as the populations are in looking at social issues. And so you leave people behind. You're supposed to be guiding them, but then they don't agree with you. And instead of just tolerating it, they decide they're not going to attend. So, you know, I'm of the Jewish faith, but I admire the new Pope actually a lot because he's, I think, modernizing and being more inclusive in how he's looking at the issues related to Catholic Church. Mm. I know in the Jewish faith, the younger Jewish people are not joining in nearly the numbers that their parents and grandparents were, and so synagogues are merging, and things are changing a lot. I know in Philadelphia, where I live, a strong Catholic community, Catholic school attendance is down. So I don't think this issue is belonging to one religion at all. I think it's common, and you know, when the church decides to stand for something and their young people don't like it, they put at risk the fact that they might be leaving the community, and that's, I think, another reason that this that the numbers are going down. Yeah. And I, you know, it's hard to stay current because the pendulums can swing really fast, and I know that institutions sometimes don't swing as fast as people can.
Yeah, call here from Martin in White Bear Lake. Hey, Martin, hi. Thanks for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm kind of like you. I practice Lutheran religion of the ELCA, and long-time giver, just like my parents. But in the last, probably the last 5 years, I've demanded more transparency from my church. And what I mean by that is that I've asked those direct questions. I've asked how much are the pastors making individually, how much are certain people making. And I even went to the national headquarters because when I asked at my church, I was told it was none of my business.
Wow.
Now, I work in state government, and the people of Minnesota provide me with an income, and it's readily available online, how much, right down to the nickel, how much I make, and as it should be, because the people are paying my paycheck. Uh-huh. And when I'm paying the paycheck of the pastors and the teachers and the janitors, I expect that I should know how much they make.
Stacey, it sounds like Martin's church is one of those that you said has kind of been left behind on this idea of more transparency.
Yeah, but it's great that you're asking the question. So congratulations to you for doing that, because that helps them understand why you might not be giving when, you know, they turn you down. So it's important to keep asking, even though it's really quite frustrating sometimes to hear those answers. I think there's another important point. You know, you said you don't want to pay necessarily for a salary you don't know about. We're all paying. You get a tax deduction when you give to charitable causes. And assuming that, you know, people are taking those deductions, it's not just a decision between the donor and the nonprofit, but it's really an agreement with all of the taxpayers. And that's why we expect transparency of our nonprofit organizations. We should know where the money's going, and it should be for the common good.
Martin, go ahead.
They're not being racist or sexist. And when they say that they support the LGBT community, but don't do it openly, then they're not practicing their faith. They're not practicing what Jesus said about being inclusive of all people. And when they kind of do it in the back door, saying, well, we support that, but we kind of do it, if you come in the back door, we'll marry you, but we're not going to put it out front. And to me, that's very hypocritical. And I now give my money, probably about 95% of my money, to organizations that practice the Christian faith, who are more transparent on where the money is going, and who their values match what Jesus Christ would do.
Eileen, I mean, is what Martin is doing what a lot of people are doing, and that's kind of where we started the conversation.
Right, and he's looking at spirituality different than the organized religious institutions, and I think he's a great example of how people are kind of are talking with their charitable dollars by saying, this is what I believe and this is what I'm going to support. And if the institution right before me doesn't reflect that, I'm going to find one that does. And I don't think that make, you know, that's a statement about his spirituality and belief. And clearly that's the trend. And I think that churches and synagogues and organized, you know, institutions and mosques, I think they could keep up with this, but I think it has hit them in a way that they just have you know, they're somehow steeped in some traditions that are keeping them from moving ahead. I'm hoping that they'll be able to play catch up, because I think if there was an absence of these religious institutions in our community, it would really be a great, I think every community in the United States would be greatly disadvantaged if they disappeared. It would be terrible, I think.
But they do valuable work, absolutely.
They do really valuable work, and I think they're really important, but somehow they've lost the interest of big groups of people, and I think they have their challenge ahead to figure out a way to attract people back.
Liz says on Twitter, nonprofit organization employee, I give to basic needs charities, providing to vulnerable populations. Faith is free, can be exclusive, quid pro quo, and to the phones to Claire in Morgan. Hi, Claire.
Good morning.
Hi. Sounds like you also work for a nonprofit. Is that right?
I do. And, you know, I take issue, I guess, I see on social media or get some emails, especially this time of year, from people who, you know, they want to point out how some CEOs of some nonprofits make just what they consider this huge salary, and how dare they think they could make this much from a nonprofit. And I really take issue with that, because I think a CEO to run a large, maybe nationwide or worldwide nonprofit absolutely should be making at least what their peers in the profit sector should be making. I mean, we expect these people to come in and run these multi-million dollar organizations, but do it for almost nothing. And I think if you want that experience and that know-how and that background, and you want them to work in a nonprofit, you have to be willing to pay them what they could go out and be making as a CEO at a Fortune 500. So I really encourage people to, you know, take that into consideration when they're seeing these emails come through that, oh, so-and-so makes so much money, and how dare they, because they work for a nonprofit. It's not really, if you want a strong nonprofit, you need to pay people in those leadership positions accordingly.
Agreed. Claire, I'm really glad you heard the show and you called. Stacey, I feel like it's been the few organizations where there has been excess that have kind of tainted perceptions about, you know, contributing to overhead and some of the things we've been talking about. What would you say?
Yes, for the most part, people who work at nonprofit organizations are not paid terribly well, and it's really the exception that chief executives and, you know, make extraordinary amounts of money. That said, you know, it is the number one issue for many donors. We did a poll of Americans to ask them about their confidence in charities, and the things that they trust in is the great programs and great work that nonprofits do, but they have doubts about their ability to manage their finances and salaries is absolutely the hot button issue.
Wow.
So one of the things we absolutely hope is that people will think about the fact that it does take great leadership to run an organization, and the people who are working at nonprofits do deserve to be paid well, and that that's part of the quality of the work that they do, is the fact that we should recognize that and pay appropriately.
You know, Eileen, in some ways, maybe those organizations have not done a very good job of making this case. You know, I might look askance, too, at a multi-million. I mean, OK, I'm going to be thinking about the Red Cross, because there's been a lot of trouble with the Red Cross and the way they've used their assets. But I feel like I don't understand the case that the Red Cross could make for the way that they dispersed the money the way they did and paid for the overhead that they did. What would you say?
One of the things, I think that's a great point. I mean, I am a CEO of a charity, so I understand this issue day to day. You know, in order for an organization to thrive, it really needs great leadership, and you need critical thinking skills, management skills, fiscal understanding of how to manage on the short run and the long run. You need knowledge of human resources. And whatever the mission is of your organization, you need to be an expert in that. And so it does take a certain kind of a leadership, and I think that people don't realize the complexity of a lot of these big charities like the Red Cross and what it takes to do that. And I think, you know, part of what charities do are marketing and communications. And so explaining your case, whether you're the Red Cross or whether you're the soup kitchen or a religious organization, you have to be able to have a really clear vision and statement about what it is, what you do, how you're doing it, and why you're doing it. And, you know, these big organizations that are national, even global, have to have a lot of clarity in that. And the Red Cross stumbled a little bit, especially after 9/11 and some of the Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
I think, and you know, I think they were doing what they always did Haiti exactly, but they weren't explaining it as clearly, and they had some leadership changes because of it. And you know what? We need to have really clear messages to donors and stakeholders, government officials. To, you know, the deduction is important, that we need to be really clear about what we're doing and how we're doing, and to be transparent. And so if you can imagine, if you're managing all those things on the fiscal side and your mission, you know, these are really complicated jobs. You know, nobody gets stock options. You know, the retirement opportunities and charities are much more modest than they are in the for-profit sector. So you need people that are really mission-driven and are smart to do this kind of work. And I feel sad that that people think that if you're running a complex organization, you shouldn't get paid, because a lot of people know that the work charities do is so important to communities. I mean, you know, we fill gaps where the government can't fill them.
Absolutely.
We come up with new ideas. And so we're in a great dilemma, and sometimes we do well and sometimes we stumble in the public arena and public opinion.
Paul says, I grew up in a small town and the only Mercedes was owned by the Lutheran pastor. Could have been family money, but was bad PR. And Reverend Darby here says, I'm pastor of ELCA Church and surprised at the caller who wasn't given finance info from the church. My members know how all of our money is spent. And to Pete in Hudson, Wisconsin. Pete, it sounds like you belong to a church as well, where there is more transparency.
Yeah, we attend a small church in River Falls, Wisconsin, and we had the opportunity to make an investment in the church by putting solar panels on our roof. And I think as I'm a millennial, that really spoke to, you know, a real public image of what the church stood for in terms of care and stewardship for creation. But it was also, you know, as an investment, a way to give to this organization that we care about, but also get some dividends back in the power that we produce. And so it was this ongoing gift that I think has also kind of had the side effect of getting us as a family more invested in the mission of the church and the life of the church, and has kind of solidified our place in it because we feel like we've bought in, you know what I mean? So I think that was an interesting way to give that wasn't just another offering in the offering plate that you know, has a long-term impact.
Right. So this idea of the specific projects, Pete, was something that, well, it seemed like the church was being, the leadership was being transparent about it, and everybody knew exactly how the money was going to get spent.
Right. And like I say, it was a real, real visible symbol.
Right.
Something that I think
right.
we as a generation care about.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah.
That's where it kind of resonated with us. And like I say, too, it's something that's going to be there for the next 20 years. And every time you show up for church, even if you don't want to get up on a Sunday morning,
there it is.
Hey,
thanks for the call. Good to have it. Conversation this morning about how we're giving and how we're thinking about giving to religious institutions as compared to the other charitable giving that we do. And this has led to, I think, a really interesting thread here about transparency and accountability, which our guests tell me is a very hot topic in the nonprofit world. Stacey Palmer with us, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy magazine, and Eileen Heisman with us, CEO of the National Philanthropic Trust. I want to hear more about what this means to you kind of day to day within maybe your belonging to a faith community of some sort, how you think about giving. Interesting to hear from Paul in Hudson about, you know, giving specifically for a project. If you've pulled away a bit from just giving to the faith community and you're giving more specifically to other organizations, tell me why. Tell me how you're thinking about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and right back to it on the other side of news. Mike, what are you watching this hour?
Well, right now, Secretary of State John Kerry is preparing, or is delivering, rather, his last policy speech on Mideast peace. The senior Israeli cabinet minister ahead of the speech already called it a, quote, pathetic step. Tensions between the two close allies have risen over the U.S. refusal to veto a U.N. resolution calling Israeli settlements a violation of international law. Meanwhile, President-elect Donald Trump is accusing President Barack Obama of throwing up inflammatory roadblocks during the transition of power. Trump has made it clear he's unhappy with Obama's recent boast that he would have won the election if he'd been running. Fewer Americans signed contracts to buy homes in November. The National Association of Realtors says its seasonally adjusted pending home sales index fell 2.5% to its lowest reading since the start of 2016. The decrease likely reflects rising mortgage rates and the shallow inventory of properties on the market. Three earthquakes ranging from magnitude 5.5 to 5.7 struck early today, about 70 miles southeast of Lake Tahoe. Their rumblings were felt across areas of Nevada and California. There were no immediate reports of injuries. And police in southern Switzerland say the body of an American hiker, who apparently fell nearly 500 feet, has been found in the region known for the famed Matterhorn Peak. Police say they've identified the 52-year-old man but declined to release his name or home, citing Swiss privacy laws. 31 degrees under sunny skies right now in the Twin Cities. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 10:41.
Yes, I am already getting questions. Where is that end-of-year book list? It will be on the thread, nprnews.org/thread. I was going to say donate, /thread, for the book list. And why not? Also donate. If you tune in specially for our book conversations and you love these author interviews that I do, it's one reason to be a member of Minnesota Public Radio. So on this day, at the end of the year, nprnews.org/donate as well. And thanks.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, I sit down with Twin Cities Archbishop Bernard Hebda. He reflects on his first months as permanent archbishop, the archdiocese pending bankruptcy, and more. Join us at 11.
Programming supported by the Minnesota Academy of Otolaryngology. Otolaryngologists are ear, nose, and throat surgeons specializing in head and neck cancer, facial plastic surgery, and sleep, sinus, voice, and hearing disorders. ENTMN.org.
What will a lot of you be listening to on the podcast? Oh, I think it's going to be that Best Books of the Year show at 9 o'clock. How to find it if you've never podcasted, really? Really simple. Listen on demand. Listen whenever you want. And just go to nprnews.org or NPR News with Carrie Miller. And wherever you get your podcast, you can download it right there. So check it out. That ought to be your resolution for 2017. I'm going to learn how to podcast, and then I'll be in control of whenever I want to listen. So check it out there. Back to the discussion this hour. We're talking about giving, religious giving, and philanthropic giving with Stacey Palmer and Eileen Heisman. And I want to go to a call here from Susan in St. Paul. Hey, Susan, thanks so much for waiting. I know it took a while. It's good to have year.
Thank you. Thank you.
What do you want to say?
Well, so I practice the Catholic faith. I'm a longtime giver, but I have also substantially reduced the amount that I give, primarily because of how I'm seeing the church spending the money.
Mm.
The significant funding of for the opposition of the marriage amendment at the same time that the church is wanting to declare bankruptcy because of the legal cost that goes into defending priests against sexual abuse.
Uh-huh.
So it's like neither one of those two things I want to spend money on.
Did you communicate that to your church, by the way?
You know, the only way that I really can communicate to my church is, I mean, I have had discussions with my local priest, but the best way to communicate to the church is to reduce the funding on these generic,
wow,
into the generic pool.
Yeah.
If there is a fundraiser for something specific to the church building, I will give to that.
Mm-hmm.
I will give to scholarships for the school. So if I can pinpoint where my donation is going, then I will fund it. But this is a case where I know that a significant amount of what goes into the donation pool every month is just simply sent in to fund these other activities.
Right. Eileen, I mean, this is a real issue of trust that I think we're hearing in Susan's call, don't you?
It is. And, you know, in the early 2000s in Boston, a group of Catholic citizens contacted National Philanthropic Trust, where I work and have worked for a long time, and asked if they could create a donor advised fund is the name of it, of what this is, if they could do it so they could put money aside for things that they wanted to fund in their Catholic
community in Boston without giving money to the archdiocese there, because they didn't want to fall away from being Catholics, but they had the same concerns as the caller. And they ended up with the arrangement didn't work out with us. They may have done something else similar, but they were actually looking formally as a group to do exactly what the caller said. And so I think when, you know, you see this institution that you embrace parts of it, but not all of it, you know, you get, there's a lot of tension. And what is it that you do to express yourself? And withholding money certainly is a way that speaks to people. But over the long run, you know, what happens to the institution? And it's just, it's a complex problem, and the solutions are complex too, I think.
Sandra says on Twitter here, 33-year-old, part of a Christian church we love giving to because it sustains both faith and local communities, shares our social justice values. Leah says, I'm under 35 and give to my church and other organizations. I like to diversify my giving. And Krista says online, when the pastor of my church praised God during a Sunday service for giving him a new BMW for his birthday, I redirected my 10% tithing from solely going to the church to directly supporting several charity and community programs. Stacey, I was reading about tithing in, I think it was Relevant magazine, and it reports that only about 5% of the American population that gives to religious institutions tithes. I wondered if the idea of tithing is just outdated.
Well, I think it's still strong in the religions that promote it. So certainly you see the Mormon Church makes that a very important kind of thing. And whenever we do studies of giving, Utah is always the most generous of all the states when you look at per capita giving. And that's because a lot of people do tithe. So it still is something that is important to certain religions, but it's not as widespread, and I don't think people think of it. Sometimes people, though, ask, you know, what is a guideline to decide what's appropriate for giving? And, you know, that 10% is pretty steep for a lot of folks to give. And certainly, you know, we were talking earlier in the hour about the 2% of GDP that goes to charitable giving. And so that suggests that, you know, most people are not giving a very high percentage of their income to charity, but perhaps they could give more. And certainly we see the very wealthy giving high dollar amounts and the very poor giving giant proportions of their income to charity. So it's all over the map.
Are you saying, Stacey, I want to make sure I was clear on what you said, that the very wealthy are giving larger percentages of their wealth to charity?
High dollar amounts.
You said high dollar amounts. But...
yes. I said percentage when I was talking about the poor. Now, there's certainly some wealthy people who have taken the giving pledge who have promised that they're giving at least 50% of their wealth away, which is pretty dramatic. So, you know, certainly many wealthy people are thinking about those things. But, you know, when you look at the proportion of dollars that are given, certainly the wealthy who have done pretty well in this country are giving quite high dollar amounts.
Eileen, could the very wealthy be giving more?
You know, we deal with a lot of high net worth individuals at National Philanthropic Trust, and I find them to be enormously generous. And so I, you know, giving more, I guess it depends on which, you know, which group you pick. I mean, the ones, of course, we experience are the ones that are looking to getting their kids involved and are really seeing their legacies left, not necessarily by how much money they made, but by the impact they've had in their community, however they define community. So I find them, the ones that I know and understand they're giving, to be generous. I'm sure there are those that don't give at all or that aren't really motivated. I kind of have a triage theory of philanthropy. There's people that are going to give regardless of whether they have a deduction or not. They're born generous. They are generous. There's those with a little education and the charities educating them on what's going on are get to be generous. And there's some category that no matter what you do, they're just not going to give back. So I don't know if there's anything you can do about that third category, but I think the high net worth in the United States actually are enormously generous.
Still want to hear from you if you've just tuned in. I think this is an interesting element of this. If you're 35 and under and you belong in some way to a faith community, how do you think about giving to that church or that faith community in comparison to the way you think about giving to other organizations that you support, other charitable organizations? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2000. 28. The pastors are starting to call, Stacy and Eileen, and that's a good thing to Todd and Wilmer. Todd, you're a pastor?
Yes, I am in Spicer, Minnesota.
Okay.
I am very grateful for the caller who brought up transparency, because that's tremendously important. But all too often, congregations or members of congregations only ask for one-sided transparency. And that is, we'd like to know how much the pastor makes, but no one asks how much the pastor gives. And I think if congregations knew the faithful stewardship of their spiritual leaders, they would be surprised to find that oftentimes someone who is making less than the income of someone with equal education and degree gives proportionately quite a bit more than others in that same boat. Now, that's a generalization, but I know in my denomination of the ELCA that pastors are encouraged to be very upfront about sharing their stewardship story, their financial stewardship story, because it's tied to a faith story.
Todd, may I just ask you, since we're a little short on time, do you have you seen the amount of giving to the church, specifically to the church, declining?
I have seen it declining, yes.
Okay. And what do you say to the congregation about that?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to speak about the abundance that God has given to us, and then how God invites us to respond with our abundant gifts. But too much of organized faith has become commercialized for folks. So if people don't like what they're receiving, they decide that, well, I'll have to give something else then, or give somewhere else. And they don't necessarily view their stewardship, their financial stewardship, and their time and treasure stewardship as an act of faith. And
okay.
I think that's one of the challenges that are before faith communities as well, to show that financial stewardship is really an act of showing your trust in God's abundance.
Okay. Stacy, what do you make of that?
Those are just terrific points. And I think it's a great question to ask how much he or she gives. That's a fabulous question. And, you know, those are the kinds of things that it's terrific to hear people talking about. And, you know, these financial management issues are incredibly important, and people shouldn't be shy about asking them.
Yeah. So the next time you want to know how much the pastor makes, you should also be asking how much the pastor gives. I think that's excellent. John says here on Twitter, it sounds like you're saying folks can love their church and its causes, but not give to it and assume the church will still be there when you need it. Yes, hold churches accountable. Remember that withholding giving forces churches to do less by cutting. Eileen, I guess I should just ask this straight out. How are religious institutions reacting to this?
You know what? They're merging, they're closing, they're combining buildings, they're sharing use of buildings. I mean, it's really, when less money goes, they can't sustain these beautiful buildings that were often built 100 years ago or a long time ago. And so that's really forcing them. The same thing as if your household budget gets cut, what do you do? You know, you have to tighten your belt. One of the things I thought when I was getting ready for this is that I thought was an interesting fact is that only 40% of congregations offer online giving and 70% of all other charities offer it. So millennials and a lot of people are giving online. So, you know, the church, the places of worship have to, you know, figure out if they're not raising money, or there's some really easy things you can do to make it better. And that might be one of them. That's not going to address the entire problem, but it might help a little bit.
You know, and Stacey, I was curious real quick here. I went to a religious affiliated college. It actually happened to be a Franciscan college. Are those colleges also seeing the same trend here as we're seeing with religious organizations?
Yeah, colleges in general are facing questions, especially from the millennials, about whether they're the best charities to support. They look at groups that are working overseas, say, and they say, my college seems pretty rich. I don't necessarily know that I need to give to it, even if the college is not. But, you know, so many colleges are retooling the way they ask for money, in part to respond to the millennials, and really seeing quite a difference in how they give. So, you know, I think we're going to see the consequences of that playing out in all of our charitable giving.
Boy, that's exactly what I say. My college seems rich, and they don't need my money. I'm putting it somewhere else. To the phones, to Jessica in St. Cloud. Hey, Jessica. Hi.
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 How are you?
Good. Do you give to your faith community?
Not anymore.
How come?
I used to be a faithful giver, and during the 2008 election, when our pastor at our Evangelical Free Church used the pulpit to give a political endorsement, that really turned me away, and I felt alienated then within my faith community that clearly I must be disconnected, and I didn't want to support an organization that was promoting political thought when they were getting, you know, tax-free exemption for religious thought. And so that really turned me off, and I stopped giving, and eventually I stopped going.
Wow. Wow. So beware of the political pronouncements from the pulpit. Did you ever tell the pastor how you felt?
I did, and he said ours is a faith, and it really came down to the single issue of abortion. He said ours is a faith that is pro-life.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, my faith is pro-life too, but my political vote goes a different way, and I felt really alienated. And he just kept coming back to, well, our faith is this way, our faith is this way. And I felt like, okay, well, then that must not be my faith, and I have to, you know, seek elsewhere.
Well, I'm so glad you called, Jessica. Thank you. Eileen, what do you hear in that?
You know, I think that talks a lot to the diversity and inclusiveness. And I know there's a lot of criticisms of people being politically correct. But I think when you're talking about faith issues, you know, the idea of including a lot of different people that believe things and having a broad common denominator, the more you say things like that pastor decided they needed or wanted to say, you know, you start excluding people. So if you want a broad base of people that you share your faith with, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to make political comments. And so it's sad. I mean, I think people want spiritual guidance and a connection that spirituality provides. And unfortunately, you know, the places of worship aren't making those connections like they once did.
All right. Eileen, such a pleasure to have you on the show. I really feel like I learned a lot from what you and Eileen and Stacy brought to us. So thank you.
It's great to be here. And I really commend you for this topic. It's a wonderful topic for people to think about.
Yeah, thank you. Stacy, thank you so much. Really good to have your insight and your experience with this.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Just want to hear from Grant in Eden Prairie. Hi, Grant. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there.
Yeah, I thought I'd give you the last word on this. Tell me.
Yeah. So I'm 22, just graduated from college and just began working and I guess having my own income and growing up in a very generous family and being able to donate on my own. Me and my wife, we both donate the standard, I guess, tithing 10% to our own faith community that we're involved with.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we're actively involved in some nonprofits. And so that's where we're actively involved in our church as well as these nonprofits that we're donating to. And so I guess being actively involved in the church community as well as these nonprofit organizations, I guess just donating to places that we have personal experiences with and we have personal, I guess, input onto where those donations are going, I guess, through our own involvement.
You sound like you really have a good philosophy about this.
Yeah, they're both things that the church, obviously, and then these nonprofits that we help with are both things that have radically transformed our lives. And so we want to be able to see our money have direct impact to transforming other people's lives.
Grant, I appreciate the experience on this. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
You can talk to me about it on Twitter, where listeners say a shift from scarcity to abundance. Yes, talk to me about how you give, especially if you're 35 and under. How you think about giving to your faith community, because we're seeing a generational change in this. You can tweet me at @CarrieMPR. You can also, while you're online and while you're tweeting, go to mprnews.org/donate. It's the end of the year. If you support our mission here at Minnesota Public Radio, we make it pretty easy for you. Just nprnews.org/donate, like Bonnie and John from Edina, who say we need the integrity of NPR and NPR as a source of honest, researched, reliable news. And you have our gratitude for your contribution.